Blog Talk Radio.
Texas on Tuesday, April 12th. You know, over the last few years, we've been following a lady from Colorado. We've had her on the show several times, and we've been following her activities on Twitter and on Facebook. And this lady is just absolutely fantastic. Her community activities, her involvement in politics are very impressive. Quite a role model, really, for a lot of other people in our movement. And now she's written a book. So that makes the circle complete. You know, when you're active and you write a book, I guess that is really, really amazing. So let me put her right on the air, because I think this is going to be just an absolutely great show. Hello, Laura Carno. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, Silvio. How are you?
Absolutely great. You know, as I said, we've known you for a few years, thanks to our mutual friend Melanie Storm, who introduced us, I think, back in 2012, and I'm every single day I see what you're doing on Facebook and on social media, and now you've written a book. But before we get into any of that, just kind of bring us up to date. How did you become a political activist and an author? What got you interested in all of this a few years ago?
You know, I had a career in banking. I was very content to be doing some things in the banking industry and in sales and marketing and technology. And in 2008, as we know, in the banking industry, we had all of the bank troubles, the TARP legislation going through. And even though my bank wasn't affected, everything kind of shut down on new projects. So the project I was working on got canceled, and I was laid off in 2008, thinking it was the worst thing that could have ever happened to me. And I just sort of tripped and fell into politics and never looked back. So it wasn't one of those purposeful things. I started paying attention to how I could participate locally, and that was during the 2008 presidential race, and just volunteered and walked and called and did things like that, and one thing led to another, and here I am with a book.
That's right.
So.
No, isn't that amazing? It's amazing how things happen in life. I think all of us, have experiences similar to yours. I think we didn't like the way things were going in the country, so we got involved, and everybody's doing whatever they can do, whether it's to write a book, do a show, write a column. Whatever the case, but it is really cool to have you on the show tonight. Now, before we get to your book, and I'm going to let you say the title of the book in a minute, because it's a great title, and I want you to say it for us. But before we get to that, I need to ask you about what is happening in Colorado, because everybody's talking about what happened there over the last 48, 72 hours. You sort of get two perspectives. On one hand, you get the perspective that they stole Donald Trump's delegates. On the other hand, the Ted Cruz people say, well, not so fast. We were just better at playing the game. So what do you say, being there on the ground? What happened?
Sure. So I'll tell you the difference in media coverage first is the national news is saying exactly what you said. You're hearing from one thing from the Trump camp, a different thing from the Cruz camp. What we're hearing in Colorado media, by and large, is this is how our caucus system works. I'm sorry if you don't like it or you don't understand it, but this is how it works. So let me take a step back. And I come from a primary state. I'm originally from California, and moving here to a caucus state, it seemed very strange. But it's the way that Colorado does their selection of candidates by party, and both Republicans and Democrats do this. So back in March, we had our caucuses, and these are neighborhood meetings where, in my particular precinct, had 46 people attend, and we had to elect a number of people from our precinct to go to county. and then to go to the congressional district, and then to go to the state. So it, everything started at those neighborhood meetings. And if you weren't at those neighborhood meetings in March, you couldn't go on to those higher levels. So what really happened is that the Cruz people have been on the ground for the last 8 months, and Donald Trump hired their first person last Wednesday. So you can't be absent since March and not try to drive your supporters to caucus and then expect that at the state assembly that you're going to be able to win. That's just not how it's done here. So Ted Cruz's campaign outworked Donald Trump's campaign and got the delegates. So that's what we see here in Colorado, knowing our process, and the local news isn't covering it the same way the national news is.
Right, and unfortunately, too many, I've seen in social media today, you get both extremes, you know, one side saying they stole it, another guy, you know, some people are even going as far as saying the end of democracy, which is, I think, a bit hysterical. But I think you're right. I mean, states have very unique rules. I attended a Republican convention here in Dallas a couple of times. I've been a delegate, and yes, I mean, these conventions have rules, and if you're running for president, you better have your team on the ground. And this is something that Donald Trump has not done well. He doesn't seem to have a good team on the ground, and not just in Colorado, but in other places as well. And I think the Trump people are going to have to understand that there's more to running for president than just having your guy, you know, just sit back and run. I mean, this is a complicated and tedious process, and I just think they got outplayed, as you just said. I think the Cruz people just, you know, if this was a chess game, they beat them at the basics of chess, Laura.
Yeah, absolutely. And it caused Cory Gardner, who is one of our U.S. senators from Colorado, to kind of go after Donald Trump last night on Twitter and say, if you can't figure out the Colorado caucus system, how are you going to balance the budget? And he had this whole stream of Twitter questions that started like that. If you can't figure out the Colorado caucus system, how are you going to defeat ISIS? And I think it's actually a good question. This is a pretty basic thing. If you don't have a team in place that understands how the game is played, and then you can play by the rules the very best you can, you can't just stomp your feet and take your marbles and go home and say, I didn't like the rules. These are the caucus rules, and Cruz's camp understood that, and like I say, they've been on the ground for 8 months.
Right, and I think the rules were sent out to all the candidates months ago, so the Trump people should have had somebody read them and at least figure out what to do. Well, let's get to your book. I love the title, but I want you to say it because I'm sure you love saying it. I wrote a book too, and I used to love telling people the title. So you tell me the title.
Sure. It's called Government Ruins Nearly Everything. And the subtitle is Reclaiming Social Issues from Uncivil Servants. Mm. And I picked that name, Government Ruins Nearly Everything, because every time I would speak on these sorts of topics, it was just a line I said. Why would we let the government take over anything, try to fix anything? They ruin everything they touch. And it was always the last line. And it was one of those things, whether I was talking to a Republican group, a Democrat group, a non-political group, everybody got it. Everybody thought that really encapsulated what the problem was.
That's right. And now, in your book, you identify four activities or four things that, in your opinion, and I agree with you, should be done by people at the state level. So why don't we go through them? You've got education, abortion, marriage, and one more. Guns. Okay, there you go.
Right.
So why don't we go one by one, and you just tell me, you know, how that works. Let's start with education. I assume you're not a big fan of Common Core.
Not at all. And let me take one step back just to frame all of them. In the first part of the book, I set up why government can't fix anything. They're not made to fix anything. They are made to see a problem, invent a problem, throw vast amounts of our money on it. It doesn't work, So they think the problem's bigger and it needs more of their solution. So they're just not, they're not built to fix things. And so if our social issues are so important to us, why do we keep turning them over to the government to fix, thinking that they actually are? So in each of the sections, and we can go one by one, I give examples of how people today, and this isn't necessarily federal versus state. These are people like you and I, Silvio, who wake up with something on our hearts in the morning and say, I really want to fix this thing, and they've done something outside of government.
Right, and I think a perfect example of that, I know we're not going to talk about healthcare specifically, but a perfect example of that, at least in my mind, are these little sisters who are providing healthcare to these people, elderly and people for free, who now have to deal with Obamacare. So Obamacare is actually preventing these sisters, I think they're in Colorado if I remember correctly, but these sisters, these religious sisters, who are providing health care, and now, you know, the government is actually making it difficult for them to do something they've done for decades. And to me, that's an example. Well, let's go one by one. Let's go to education. Why don't we begin with that one? Tell
sure.
me your view of that.
We have a federal Department of Education, and I'm thrilled to hear presidential candidates talking about abolishing that. But we have a federal Department of Education that since its inception has spent more than $1 trillion of our money trying to help education, trying to improve schools. And they haven't. $1 trillion later, there's only a very, very marginal change in a number of the educational statistics, and many of them have gone down. What we're also seeing from a solution standpoint is that parents now have more choice than they've had in a very long time through the charter school revolution. And we're even seeing private schools throughout the country whose specialty, and you know, private schools used to be for the children of very wealthy people, but private schools that specialize in kids in the inner city under a certain income level. Private schools that specialize. And I talk about a Arupe Jesuit school in Denver and what they're doing with kids who every single one of them are going on to the college of their choice. And these are families that didn't have parents, 50% didn't have parents that even graduated from high school, and doing wonderful things with some of our most vulnerable populations. If we can just keep the government out of it, and certainly the federal government out of it, return the choice locally, we're all in better shape.
Right, because I think that there's a misunderstanding, I believe, and maybe you agree with me on this, but there's a misunderstanding on the part of bureaucrats who believe that they somehow care more about the problem than, let's say, people in a community. I mean, if you work in a community, let's say you're a businessman and you have a small business in a particular community, you're very interested in education because you want your employees to at least know how to read and write, and you want your consumers to be, you know, to be literate and so on. So it's not just the bureaucrats who care. Everybody cares about education, and they're much closer to the problem. I know that here in Dallas, there's the First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, has a very aggressive program for education for kids who don't have any income or resources, and they do it, you know, they do it because they do it from their hearts, obviously, but they also do it because they understand that graduating good kids is really the best social program there is, Laura.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've, in the beginning of the chapter called Schools That Work, I asked that question right off. Who knows best? Do parents know best? Or does Washington know best? And the folks that think that somebody other than the parents know best, they have higher degrees on average than the rest of the population. And they might think that they know better than we do, but gosh, you talk to any parent, they know that they know their children better than any bureaucrat, and they want to have that choice in education. And the more local, the better, obviously, for exactly what you're saying. I think that you might have a different kids need to learn different things if they're being educated in New York City versus you know, a small farm town in somewhere in the middle of the country, they just might need to learn different things, and that's okay. Let those decisions be made locally where they know what they need.
Right, and locally also means that the father or the mother or the child can go down to the school board and, you know, speak directly to the people who are running their kids' education rather than some bureaucrat they have to email something to or speak to by phone. Now, the next topic is one that I was very impressed that you brought it up in your book, and that's abortion. Now, as everybody knows, abortion was made legal in 1973 by Roe v. Wade, a decision that I have never really understood because it should have been decided by state legislatures. So tell me how you treat abortion in your book.
Sure. So the chapter on abortion is called Reducing Abortions. And I do spend a little time saying, what is the goal here? We want fewer abortions. We don't want more abortions. And I say something to the effect of no sane person wants more abortions. Yes, I know Planned Parenthood and people like that, that's their business. They want more. I don't consider them sane people who would ever pick up this book because they want to see improvement. So if we can agree that we want fewer and not more, then we take a look at what can lead to fewer abortions. So I do spend some time talking about Roe v. Wade, and there are a lot of people, including almost a majority of Republicans, who don't want Roe v. Wade overturned, even though more people say today that they're pro-life than have ever said that before. And I'm drawing this trend across all four of the subjects that people don't want the government deciding, regardless of how they feel about something. A lot of people think Roe v. Wade never goes away. So if that's the case, then what do you do? And I talk about some organizations across the country that have done really, really good work with helping young girls who have a choice to make about an unwanted pregnancy and how people can help those organizations. I even talk about what Focus on the Family did in conjunction with a number of churches nationwide to help get foster kids into forever homes before they age out when they're 18. And, you know, organizations and people who really put their money where their heart is and say, we've got to do something to help children. And now you might say, what if somebody does want Roe v. Wade to go away and thinks that it will? Great. It's not going away today. So if our goal is to reduce abortion, how can we help these organizations or be inspired by these organizations to do something else on our own in our own community?
Absolutely. Now, the next topic is marriage. I found that to be very interesting as well. Tell me about that.
Sure. So I had to rewrite my marriage chapter after the Supreme Court made their ruling. The topic stands. All of the political discussion about marriage is about should we have same-sex marriage, yes or no? And when I looked at what organizations were out there actually supporting marriage to help people get and stay married, I was really hard-pressed to find one that wasn't politically involved and was just focused on marriage. So I almost felt like, as we were being distracted by this this same-sex marriage debate, we were missing the fact that 25% of millennials say they will never get married. But what we know from research is that people who are married are happier, healthier, and wealthier, and their children do better. So societally, it's good for people to get married. And I did find a great organization called the National Association for Relationship and Marriage Education. I talk about them in my book and what they're doing in the communities to help people understand who to pick for your spouse, marriage counseling, marriage workshops, parenting workshops. And this is a nonprofit organization that just focuses on marriage. They're not involved in the political debate. They just want to help married people be good, happy married people.
Yes. Now, your other topic is guns, and that's clearly a topic that gets everybody very excited. You know,
absolutely.
People run for for the partisan corner whenever that topic comes up. So how did you treat that one without being partisan?
Sure. So government ruins nearly everything. And when they are trying to reduce gun violence, and the chapter's called Less Gun Violence, when they say they're trying to reduce gun violence, they take action in legislation that has been proven and documented to do the exact opposite. So I say government just stay out of the way. Everything they do makes it worse. But I talk about some great programs that are being done around the country. One of my favorites is John Anoni, who is in Allentown, Pennsylvania, middle school teacher, didn't think he was doing enough for kids. So in addition to being a middle school teacher, he also runs a program called Camp Compass Academy, where kids learn all kinds of different skills. And the sort of the carrot at the end of the stick for them is that they get to learn hunting and shooting skills. And you say, oh gosh, Allentown's kind of a high crime area. Why would we put guns in the hands of these inner city kids? Because you know what? John Anoni is saving lives. Not one kid who has gone through Camp Compass Academy has gotten into trouble with the law, with firearms, any of that. John is saving lives. And this is just something that John woke up on his heart. He grew up in that area. He woke up with it on his heart to help save kids, and he's saving lives. And so if somebody is really concerned about gun violence, I lay out the statistics on why these gun control laws don't work and what things are working out there. And I just hope to inspire people to do like John Anoni, look in your own community and see how you can help.
Yeah. I think all of your ideas go back to the same source, it seems to me. Tell me if I'm wrong. But they go back to the same source, and it's actually very similar to what led the Founding Fathers to write the Constitution and to create a government where people were very, very, you know, very decentralized government, where the federal government had certain, certain things that it was responsible for, obviously the defense of the country and so on. But they really wanted people like you and me to address these problems. And somewhere along the way in the 20th century, we got away from that idea and we decided to let government fix these problems. And I think your point about education is so correct. I mean, look, we're spending, I mean, here in Texas, we spend $7,000 a year educating a child. That's our annual cost per child. And I've always thought to myself, my goodness, if we gave the parent of that child a voucher for $7,000, imagine the power that parent would have in just going out and picking whatever school. I'm not saying that it has to be a private school. It could be the public school. They may want to stay in the public school. It may force the public schools to be better. But again, what I'm saying is what you're suggesting in your book, I believe, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think is you want us as citizens to have more ownership of the country and to be more responsible for what happens every single day, Laura.
Right. Yeah, you're hitting the nail on the head. And you have to ask yourself the question, who is best equipped to make the decisions in your life? Is it you or is it the government? And if somebody thinks that there is somebody else that's better equipped to make decisions in their lives, then they're free to go to somebody else for that help. But I would say that most of us, Silvio, and I'd put that in the high 90s, really want to make all those decisions for ourselves, from you know, how our toilets flush in our homes to what kind of light bulbs we're permitted to buy. The founders never would have dreamed that these little decisions that we make on a daily basis in our homes would be so controlled by the government.
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. As I say, somewhere in the 20th century, we walked away from that. We disconnected from that idea, and I think we need to go back to it. And, without throwing away every program, because some programs have been good, but for the most part, like you say, they've taken away power from the locals and given it to the federal government, and the results are not the best. Anything else about your book that you want to tell the audience? Any point that we have not covered?
You know, there's an undercurrent in the whole book that freedom is messy business. And if you want freedom for yourself, then you got to be okay with the other guy's freedom, because somebody else might do with their freedom something you don't necessarily like. And obviously, we're not talking about harming other people. But, you know, if your neighbor wants to feed his children unpasteurized milk and take the risk because they know it's safe, they feel it's safe. We should stop wagging our finger at every little thing our neighbors do because we want freedom for ourselves. So it's not about I get my freedom and then I want my neighbor to have my freedom, my kind of freedom. People need to have their own freedom. They need to exercise their own freedom as long as they're not harming other people. And that's hard for some people. They want people to be like them. And you know, you can use this example of if my neighbor has freedom to marry who he wishes, and I don't really like that, but he doesn't like the fact that I have guns. Can we get okay with that? Can I be okay with the fact that my neighbor married somebody I don't like? And he can get okay with the fact that I'm a firearms owner. So I'm really challenging people to say freedom is messy business. It might make us a little uncomfortable, but let's think about this because freedom is important because freedom is important.
Absolutely. I think at the end of the day, a society built along the lines that you've just described, where you have two neighbors who have different likes and different influences but somehow coexist, If you can build a society like that, I think you will have a more peaceful society, and frankly, a more happy society, because you're not going to have all of this second guessing. Where the First Lady of the United States is telling you and other mothers across the country what to feed your kids. You know, my philosophy is let Mrs. Obama do her, you know, worry about her daughters. And I'll let you worry about your kids, and everybody's happy, you know?
Exactly. It's our decision and our responsibility. And folks can get this book, Government Ruins Nearly Everything, on Amazon. And you can put my name in or the title of the book. And you can also link to it right from my website, lauracarno.com. That's C-A-R-N-O, lauracarno.com. It's a picture of the book. You can click on it, and they'll take you right into Amazon.
And I've put a little link to your Amazon page as well, and you can also click on that. But most of all, I want to congratulate you on the book. I understand it's doing quite well, and it's being very well received. And I just want to tell you how proud we are of having you on our team, because people like you make it fun to fight our battles. You are just a neat lady. And you're doing a great job. And, you know, I have a hard time keeping up with you because it seems like every day I see you're posting on Facebook, you're doing something else. But listen, you're an inspiration. You inspire the rest of us to have that energy and that drive to do what you do. So keep at it. A lot of people love what you do, and a lot of people are very inspired by your personality and by your drive and your ambition. And keep it up, and I wish you the very best with your book, and I hope we can chat again in the future.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you for all of those kind things you said. I really appreciate being interested in the things that we're doing out here in Colorado and continuing to have me on your show. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and have a wonderful evening, and my best to you and to your family.
Thanks, Silvio. You too.
All right. We're going to take a little break, and we will be right back. Well, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Our thanks to Laura Carno, C-A-R-N-O. As I say, we have a link to her book on our show information, but if you just go to her website, as she was indicating, you can get the book. I love what she's done. I love what she's done. She's taken four very controversial issues and has shown us how we as citizens, how we as people can resolve them. And I just, that's the way to go. As far as I'm concerned, that's the way to go. I think we as individuals know what's best for us. We know what's best for our families. And we know what's best for our communities. And, you know, the founding fathers had the same idea, so that's why it's great to see Laura with her book. Thank you for listening, folks. Have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you later.